The word reform in this in many cases has been utilized in connection with social activities, and we've been talking recently about reform or restructuring of the GBC, and things like that, and rather famously, starting around 1984, there was something in ISKCON that came to be called the Guru Reform Movement, and of which I ended up being one of the leaders of that movement, one of the things that I realized is what we call reform is first of all not something that happens once in a while but should be perpetual, and second of all that reform actually has three dimensions. The Guru Reform Movement in one sense had to do with how the position of the Guru was established in our society. But there were other issues. But it was a kind of a social issue. But I quickly realized that reform really has a personal dimension. We're just dealing with our own advancement in Krishna consciousness. Very quickly that changes to a social dimension. Because we're a social movement, we're called the Sankirtan movement. And Sankirtan means that we come together to glorify Krishna. And our process is we do this in association with devotees. Sankirtan means really if we want to go back to Godhead, we all go back together or not at all. We do this as a social or a group process. Krishna is a person. That means he has personal relationships. To be personal is to be social. The idea of a person has no meaning outside of relationships with other people. So we are also personal. Therefore we're social. And then social groups, when they become organized for action in the world, that organization is called political. The word politics has a bad meaning, but it also has a good meaning. It means how societies organize for effective action in the world as a unit. So it has a political dimension also, reform. Many times we try to fix problems in the Hare Krishna movement by dealing with the political or the social and ignoring the personal. I've sat in many meetings where people have been trying to solve problems involved with ISKCON, and it has seemed to me as though people are trying to figure out a way to have the Hare Krishna movement without the Krishna consciousness. Which I don't think is worth bothering with. So, this is what this course is going to be about. We're going to actually focus on the personal side of things, but I want to show you that the personal has this important dimension. We are very interested in how to reform ISKCON. How to manage ISKCON, how to administer ISKCON, how to improve ISKCON as a society. But we have to understand this requires a spiritual basis and a spiritual foundation. So I want to go back a little bit and talk about some of our history, of our problems in our movement, and some of the things that I understood at that time. And now we need to consider how to go forward, because I think that this needs stressing. What I want to say needs stressing. Then we'll go on to consider what we're going to talk about is sadhana, the cultivation of the holy name. But I want everybody to understand this is not just for ourselves as individuals. It's for the whole society. It's a social act. And you cannot reform other people without at the same time reforming yourself. This is the biggest mistake we can make, is to try to improve other people without trying to improve ourselves, or even as a substitute for trying to improve ourselves. So we'll discuss how to cultivate the holy name. I want to discuss this because I discovered, much to my surprise, many people in the Krishna consciousness movement, we haven't been taught properly or haven't learned properly what it means to cultivate the holy name and how to make advancement. One thing, just recently in the GBC meetings, we were discussing various things, and people, one of the biggest problems our movement faces is that very senior devotees have fallen down. This, of course, is bad in many ways, and it creates doubts in everybody's mind. You know, if this devotee or that devotee who's been serving for so long and has taken so much responsibility, if he can fall down, what's going to happen to me? Well, there's an answer how not to fall down. In many cases, I've discovered that we have problems simply because we haven't really been following the process properly. And so it has nothing to do with guru philosophy or structuring or anything like that, but it has to understand the process. So I think you'll find this useful on a very practical level. And even if you don't have some particular position in the management and administration of ISKCON, because you have friends, you influence them, they influence you, and the circle of association goes out. So that's what this... it's basically about a personal activity, but I always want to see this as part of our social obligation and social activity. I want to read you a few things that Prabhupada said concerning management of ISKCON. Because sometimes when you start talking about the spiritual side of things, people get a little upset. They want to be more practical. There was one time there was Prabhupada came to the Vrindavan temple, and there was a devotee there who was the president, I guess was not particularly good at running things. Prabhupada, there was some urgent matter there. He came all the way from Africa, flew thousands of miles. And he got there and he found terrible mismanagement. The temple was still in the last stages of construction. Prabhupada walked in the temple room and there were these big light fixtures, these chandeliers hanging down. And birds had nested in the chandeliers. Prabhupada had told people several times it shouldn't be allowed to happen. You know, when the birds stay there, then there's bird droppings on the floor and the devotees in kirtan, the bird is dirty. And Prabhupada had stressed before, these birds have to be kept out of the chandeliers, out of the light fixtures. Prabhupada said, I have to fly 5,000 miles just to tell you not to let the birds nest in the chandeliers. Then they walked outside and they were laying tile down, walking tile on the sidewalk. And Prabhupada noticed that many of the tiles were cracked. And he said, you've allowed yourself to be cheated. The people bringing the tile had substituted inferior, cheap material for the real material. It shouldn't have been cracked. What they would do is the first dozen tiles would be first quality, and then after that, they're all bad, and you check the first few, it's fine. And so Prabhupada said this had happened, but the temple presidents, more or less, tried to argue with Prabhupada that, no, they're supposed to be cracked, it was part of the design, which Prabhupada didn't take too kindly. And everybody went into Prabhupada's room, and they sat down, and Prabhupada said, so, what is to be done? What is to be done? And somebody would say something, Prabhupada would shoot it down. Won't work. Somebody would say something else, he would shoot it down. Somebody would say something else, he would shoot it down. Finally, there was a silence. I heard this on the tape. I wasn't there, but I heard the tape. And somebody said, well, Prabhupada, I guess we'll just have to be Krishna conscious. And Prabhupada said, another impractical suggestion. So that was his sarcasm, I guess. But what I want to say is I don't think it is impractical. Although he was simply a little disgusted at the time. So this is a letter Prabhupada wrote in 1972. There had just been a big uproar in ISKCON. Prabhupada had suspended the GBC, actually, doing some stuff. So he wrote to one of the GBC members, let us forget past incidences and let us look forward to rectifying our defects. So far you are concerned, I'm very much convinced of your sincere service. Go on with your work, and other instructions will follow. Simply become more concerned with increasing the spiritual content of our lives, and in this way, all other problems, like management, will be easily solved. Not that they can be solved by making some legal formula and having big, big meetings and talks. Politicians have been holding such meetings and talks for some time now, and the world is no better place for it. And they have only made things worse. We should not follow their example. The world is in a very precarious condition simply for lack of God consciousness, so this should be our point of stressing, that we should revive this emphasis on God consciousness everywhere in the world, and that will be our contribution. So then he says, same year, same month, same year, another person, temple president. So far you're concerned about management. The solution is to be always thinking of Krishna and the spiritual master. Then Maya cannot touch you. If you very strictly follow the regulative principles and chant 16 rounds minimum, there's no question of ever falling down. Now, do you believe him when he says that? That's what he says. If you very strictly follow the regular principles and chant 16 rounds minimum, but you could say, I guess that's by definition, that's not falling down. But there's a way to do this that gives us protection. Krishna has given you very nice facility, so you continue to serve him with great faith and enthusiasm, and he will give you all blessings. Here's another letter, same year actually, 72. I am little observing now, especially in your country, it's America, that our men are losing their enthusiasm for spreading our programs of Krishna consciousness movement. Otherwise, why so many letters of problems are coming? Dissatisfied. That is not a very good sign. The whole problem is they are not following the regulative principles. That I can detect. Without this, enthusiasm will be lacking. Even mechanically following, if he gets gradually understanding from the class, he will come to the point of spontaneous enthusiasm. This spontaneous loving devotional service is not so easy matter, but if one simply sticks strictly to the rules and regulations, like rising early, chanting 16 rounds, chanting Gayatri, keeping always clean, then his enthusiasm will grow more and more, and if there is also patience and determination, one day he will come to the platform of spontaneous devotion then his life will be perfect. All of this I've told you in Nectar of Devotion. So I do not think the leaders are themselves following, nor are they seeing others are following strictly. That must be rectified at once. This is to a GBC member, 1972. And then a little later on, I think this is in the same letter. Yes, same letter. So my point is that the regulative principles must be followed by everyone. Otherwise, their enthusiasm dwindles and they again think of sex and become restless. And so many problems are there. There is some symptom of missing the point. I'll skip a little bit. So the future of this Krishna consciousness movement is very bright. So long the managers remain vigilant that 16 rounds are being chanted by everyone without fail. That they're all rising before 4 morning, attending Mangalarti. Our leaders should be careful not to kill the spirit of enthusiastic service, which is individual and spontaneous and voluntary. I want you to notice how Prabhupada put these two things together in the same sentence. One sounds very regulation. Force them to get up, force them to go to Mangalarti, force them to chant their rounds. See, these are rules and regulations. That's what it sounds like. Vigilance, 16. How many rounds did you chant? You know, that. How do you enforce this if you're a leader? 16 rounds, rising before 4 o'clock, attending Mangalarti. And then he says, our leaders should be careful not to kill the spirit of enthusiastic service, which is individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. So this means that if the leaders are just trying to get people to do these things by force, it's not what Prabhupada means. Actually, it will not last. I've seen that if new devotees get trained up by some heavy bhakta leader who's always on top of them, get up in the morning, did you do this, did you do that, pressure is there all the time, then they do that for a few months and they're trained up. As soon as the pressure's off, they fall apart. So here Prabhupada is suggesting something else, and what we want to see is what is it that Prabhupada is talking about that makes people want to do this? Because it's a matter of training. It's also still a matter of training, but training may be a different way than we've always seen. They should always try to generate some atmosphere of fresh challenge to the devotees so that they will agree enthusiastically to rise and meet it. So what is the challenge? That is the art of management to draw out spontaneous loving spirit of sacrificing some energy for Krishna. So now Prabhupada comes and says it. Not to force people, but somehow to pull from them this spontaneous loving spirit. But where are so many expert managers? All of us, notice this, all of us should become expert managers and preachers. We should not be very much after comforts and become complacent or self-contented. There must always be some tapasya, strictly observing the regulative principles. Krishna consciousness must be always a challenge, a great achievement to be gained by voluntarily desire to do it, and that will keep it healthy. So you big managers now try to train up more and more some competent preachers and managers like yourself. Forget this centralizing and bureaucracy. That's what he said there. And then to another devotee. Follow the regulative principles very diligently. Maintain the highest level of standard in routine work, such as rising early, cleansing, chanting, temple worship, street sankirtan. Always keep the devotees satisfied like that. If your preaching work is strong, automatically management will be easy. And preaching work is strong if our routine work is strong. Never neglect our regular program, and that will be your success. Now, if the regular program is simply boring, if it's not a fresh challenge to inspire us to rise and meet it, then something is wrong with even the way our regular program is being instituted. So these are Prabhupada's statements about management, and we need to learn how to understand them a little more deeply. I want to go back a little bit and tell you when we ran into trouble. In ISKCON, after Prabhupada's disappearance. Most of you probably weren't here at that time, but in 1979, just 2 years after Prabhupada left, questions about the guru's position had become big topics in ISKCON Center, especially Vrindavan, India, and Juhu Beach. And devotees were right. This is before the internet. This is before even everybody had fax machines. What was available in 79 was photocopying. And people were writing papers and photocopying them and mailing them out all over. And this became so because there was some controversial behavior on the part of people who had just been established as initiating gurus, and in many people's minds this the appointed successors to Srila Prabhupada, Hamsadutta, Jayatirtha. And in May of 1980, the GBC had to have an emergency meeting in Los Angeles. And it had to take some measures to try to get some of these gurus under control, investigate them. Especially, Hamsadutta was, as it turned out, there was drugs, sex, crime, Jayatirtha, LSD, you know, as it turned out. I mean, it was not good at all. But then what happened, 3 months later, the GBC put out a philosophical position paper defending the position that the current gurus were to be understood as Mahabhagavatas. Now, a lot of people had trouble reconciling this with the fact that they just had to, you know, take several gurus and like, what's going on here? So then by 81, they had removed Hamsadutta completely from his position. And then in 82, they did the same thing with Jayatirtha. And so many senior devotees thought that there was something really wrong with going on here. And the other thing was that when, remember at that time there were only, I think, 11 initiating gurus in the movement, a very few number, that the GBC actually had no authority. When the GBC wanted to do something, these gurus said, you know, hey, who are you? You know, we're the appointed ones by Prabhupada. So there was anxiety, I think, throughout the Prabhupada disciples and senior people throughout the movement, starting just very early, 79. So this anxiety found an outlet, finally, an organized outlet, in September of 1984, in a temple in New Jersey, Tuaco. There was a routine meeting of the North American temple presidents and sannyasis. They were just going to discuss preaching strategies. But when they got together, they discovered they were all extremely nervous and upset, and they thought, they took a poll. There were 35 people present. And they took a poll and they discovered that 94% believed. All these people were disciples of Prabhupada at that time. 94% believed that, and this is, I quote, I still have these documents in my files, just, there are fundamental and compelling problems with the guru institution as it presently exists in ISKCON. That's 94% thought of. I wasn't at this meeting, but they were shocked, actually, to find out that 94% of them thought this, you know. So the group called a second meeting in November. This meeting was in September, so the next month they said, let's get back together again. These are North American temple presidents and see if we can follow up. So that's where I personally got involved. That people asked me to come to the next meeting. I wasn't at that time a temple president. I was working for the BBT and the Bhaktivedanta Institute. So at first I didn't want to hear anything about these meetings. I was so tired of people complaining and everything. And I thought, it's just going to be one of these sessions where everybody sits around and gripes and finds fault and nothing's going to happen. But I was persuaded to go to this meeting. And I was really surprised because I became enlivened and encouraged by the association and the commitment of these devotees. They weren't just, to me, they didn't seem like politicians. They seemed like genuinely worried people who were looking for some guidance. And then I realized that I was quite in a state of despair about ISKCON. Without knowing it, and about myself, and that I had been in kind of a spiritual slump, and the meeting was somehow waking me up. So at that meeting, this group asked me to conduct some research to determine what exactly had gone wrong with the way the position of the guru had been set up in ISKCON. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And I want to tell you what happened. I came back to Philadelphia, my temple, and I started to think about what I should do. And I thought the first thing, I really better get my spiritual life together so I can be clear-headed and have a brain. And so I started to really try to get my spiritual platform a higher level. And I was always been inspired by something in the preface, the Nectar of Instruction. Prabhupada says, in all spiritual affairs, this is right at the beginning of Nectar Instruction. Most people skip it and go on, but this is very good because Prabhupada's actually commenting on the first verse of Upadeshamrita. He says, in all spiritual affairs, one's first duty is to control his mind and senses. Unless one controls his mind and senses, one cannot make any advancement in spiritual life. Everyone within this material world is engrossed in the modes of passion and ignorance. One must promote himself to the platform of goodness, sattva guna, by following the instructions of Rupa Goswami. That means like, vacho vegam manasakro devegam, that first verse of Upadeshamrita. One must promote himself to the platform of goodness, sattva guna, by following the instructions of Rupa Goswami, and then everything concerning how to make further progress will be revealed. See, that's the catcher. You know, how you, here you're looking at the whole movement, we have to make some progress. How do I know what to do? Prabhupada says, put yourself in this way, then you'll know. It will be revealed, he says. So, I thought that was really good guidance, so I decided I'd better do that. And so I was thinking hard of what to do, what went wrong with ISKCON, how can we fix it. So I'll just tell you the facts of what happened. I was at this temple. The temple president at that time was Shesha. And there was a regional secretary, Mahakram Swami, who's no longer in our movement. Shesha Das, our Minister of Justice. No, he's not Trinidadian, he's American. He was the President of Philadelphia. Mahakram Swami was, and Mahakram was actually elected the Vice Chairman in Tuaco of this little reform group that started. And he was the regional secretary. At that time, the GBC and initiating guru, this was the system, there's only one initiating guru for each area, was Satyarup Maharaj. So, of course, later on, Satyarup Maharaj published a very influential book called Guru Reform. His initial reaction, as many people's initial reaction to this Tulako meeting was, they were a little disturbed. Satyarup didn't interfere with anything, but he said, you know, we have a spiritual problem, what is politics going to do to solve it? Which I could take his point, but... But he was a little worried about it. So we had a meeting, myself, Mahakram, Shesha, myself, were sitting in a room together talking about what to do. And after this meeting broke up, Shesha came to me and he said, you know, you got to be careful about what you say about Mahakram Swami, because he reports everything back to Satyarup Maharaj. He said, you should know that. That's what he said. And I was just shocked, because I thought, here we're supposed to be the reform party. They're supposed to straighten the miscon. And I'm told I can't even trust the people I'm working with. So then I realized, you know, if we can't trust each other, how are we going to be any better than anybody else? And so then I realized that what we were calling the guru problem in ISKCON was not the problem, but it was a symptom of a deeper problem in our movement. Which we were all infected with. It wasn't just them who were bad and we were good. It was all of us had this problem. Because we tend to do this. We say, you know, it's them and us. You know, there's a famous American cartoon strip, a character named Pogo, this possum from the swamp. The cartoon doesn't run anymore, but it's a kind of philosophical newspaper cartoon character in America, Pogo. And one of his mottos was, things he used to say is, we have met the enemy and he is us. So I began to get a lot of different ideas, and then what happened, I had this assignment to find out what was wrong, and then I sat down and I wrote a paper. I just wrote things down. And about what I felt was wrong. And I just sent it out to a few people. I photocopied it, put it in the mail, and it went out to about 3 people. And within 2 weeks, it was all over the movement. Remember, this other people had photocopied it and sent it to other people, and I began to get phone calls from Hawaii, why didn't you send me a copy? And all these other things. And this paper had somehow or other struck a nerve. And so what it says is, and I'll just read you a few excerpts from this paper. This is written in November of 1984. And I think to this day, basically the same problems are there, unfortunately. This paper, I would improve the writing now, but anyway, I haven't tried to update it. It starts like this: the root of all problems now facing ISKCON is that we, the disciples of Srila Prabhupada, have not yet established proper Vaishnava relationships among ourselves. Because as I got from this meeting, here we're going to worry about other people, and I discovered we couldn't trust each other. What's wrong with our relationships? What's wrong with our society? I give my analysis of what's wrong with ISKCON in this paper. And this is what I said at the time. A society of devotees in which proper Vaishnava relations are not yet the norm is called the Kanishta Adhikari Society. Its distinguishing characteristic is contentiousness, that is the tendency to quarrel, arising from envy. Envy is a product of false ego. Because of false ego, the members are unable to establish spiritual friendship among themselves. Instead, they vie with each other, compete with each other for prestige, power, and prerequisites. Intensely desiring the honor and respect of others, the contentious neophyte pretends to be more advanced than he actually is. He tries to conceal his shortcomings and fall downs, and in so doing, he develops a secretive mentality and holds himself back from entering into open and honest relations with his godbrothers. Because he cannot reveal his mind in confidence, he remains aloof from real fellowship. He strays from the path of devotional service, but his peers do not help him. For he thinks that if he allows somebody to preach to him, he implicitly admits his own subordination. Therefore, he cuts himself off from hearing and becomes impervious to instruction or good advice. Because he has many secret misgivings about himself, he becomes eager to find the faults of others. In this way, he reassures himself of his own superiority in spite of his many unacknowledged weaknesses. So in this way, this is my diagnosis. I think this is the first time anybody in ISKCON had ever put anything like this in print. And then I go on and talk about how people, if they cannot make real spiritual advancement, they substitute other things like moving up through the organization or busy to open centers or other things that are actually a substitute for real spiritual advancement. And then I also had an intuition at that time of what to do. How to get off this platform. And I said, the means is sadhana. Sadhana bhakti destroys, pursued diligently and attentively, destroys false ego. And as long as the neophyte devotees attend to their sadhana, they can be sure of elevation to higher stages. There is, however, no other assured means of advancement, and habitual negligence in sadhana is therefore fatal to progressive spiritual life. Furthermore, when a neophyte devotee has ridden to the Majjhima platform, sadhana is actually necessary, absolutely necessary, to maintain him in that position. If he becomes slack in sadhana, he rapidly falls back to the neophyte condition. So that was my solution. By the way, there are a number of people in this little reform group who are upset with this diagnosis of our problem. Because they want to say, it's those guys, it's the GBC, it's the gurus, and I'm saying, what about ours? They thought it was like, too introspective. And then at the end of this thing, I make a few statements. One thing I said, then I talk about, in ISKCON centers, trying to improve ourselves through good sadhana, and by that way then improving our relationships. Because I didn't think that unless we were improving ourselves, we could improve our relationships. So I offer this program of reform. And I said, one special advantage to this revolutionary project. So notice that sadhana is now being presented as a revolutionary act. One special advantage to this revolutionary project for the regeneration of ISKCON is that it need not wait on the action of the GBC. So how to take power in your own hands. It can be initiated in each temple immediately. It can be started by one devotee. Any devotee who wants to institute reform must begin with himself. The prerequisite for coming to the Majjhima stage is to be a strict follower of the regulative principles of devotional service. Spiritual fellowship, that is good association, cannot flourish if anarthas are not being relentlessly uprooted by daily practice. Therefore, every devotee who wants to help in the reformation of ISKCON must first carefully review his own spiritual condition and his personal devotional practices. If he is careless in observing regulative principles and slack in sadhana, he must immediately take up the process of rectification. This entails attending the complete morning program in all alertness with a special concentration on attentive offense-avoiding japa. By this effort, a devotee may quickly remove all his accommodations to sense gratification and undertake the deliberate dismantling of its false ego. I can't believe I said this in any way. Anyway, it's easy to say. A devotee of the reforming party should recognize sense gratification and false ego as the two great impediments to Vaishnava fellowship. They are the mortal enemies of ISKCON, and he should resolve to conquer them. So this is my effort to say where the enemy is, you know, here, not out there. And then I give a little more diagnosis of what the society was like under to my observation at that time. Having undertaken whatever personal reformatory measures are required, the reforming devotee should then undertake the rectification of his relationships. Most devotees will discover that few, if any, of their relationships are satisfactory. The devotee will probably see that he has almost no confidential friends and that he does not and cannot trust most of his associates. He's conscious that many of his associates have made accommodations, sometimes quite extensive, to sense gratification. Indeed, he has participated in many meetings in which the faults and shortcomings of those not present have been thoroughly examined. Yet the established patterns of relationships are such that while everybody is free to talk about them, no one is free to talk to them. In this situation, devotees find themselves standing helplessly by as they watch one of their associates sink deeper and deeper into Maya until he finally floops. No one is able to come to his aid. As the failing devotee falls further and further away, the criticism of him intensifies, but no one helps. Nor can devotees work together effectively because they have no way of working out the inevitable differences that arise in any collective effort. When one devotee transgresses against another, the offended party will either respond in wrath or retreat into wounded silence, complaining, however, vociferously to others. He does not know how to approach the other devotee and openly resolve their differences. He is unable to reveal his mind without giving offense. Under these conditions, a great stockpile of resentment builds up in time, and the atmosphere is filled with sullen undercurrents of hostility and mistrust, relieved only by periodic outbursts of anger. In this congenial climate, devotional relations become more and more burdensome, and materialistic people start to seem relatively nice. The devotees find themselves living in deepening isolation from one another, each enthroned in a well-fortified ivory tower of false ego. They learn to get along by avoiding each other. These are some of the local conditions that arise in the milieu of fratricidal strife. Anyway, that was my sort of diagnosis of our condition. And it was interesting. I said this. I just sent it out to a couple of people to get some feedback, and it's quickly spread all over the whole movement. And I began to get phone calls and everything like that. So it did speak to a lot of people's condition, how they felt. And some people said, boy, at least somebody's telling the truth, you know. Because a number of other people were quite upset by this depiction of things. I can still say that, anyway, this reform movement went on. I wrote some other papers about the institutionalization of the Guru in ISKCON. This paper kind of became, you know, forgotten. But as far as I'm concerned, it was the real thing. It was about what we really had to do. And I see that many of our problems in our society have persisted. Again, we keep looking for merely institutional solutions. So I want to go back to this paper because I think it applies a few little changes here and there all over the place. And I think that we should begin with the beginning, as they say in America sometimes, back to basics. We get back to our basics and understand, first of all, what is our practice of Krishna consciousness. Many people have become discouraged because they have been practicing Krishna consciousness and the things that have been promised have not happened or are happening very slowly. People are coming into the movement, but almost an equal number of people are leaving. People are rushing about looking for some savior here and there outside of our movement. Some people are trying to figure out how everyone can be a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, you know, as a Ritvik, and therefore that'll save us. But I think all our difficulties come from the fact that we should first try to actually follow what Prabhupada has given us. Let's understand what sadhana is and learn how to practice it. If we do this, things can change, your life can change in 5 days if it needs changing. I mean, I don't presume that many people aren't following, but if you're in a state of despair, you think things are hopeless, you could change things around. When people get hopeless about ISKCON, I've noticed that it's almost always sort of autobiographical. They feel hopeless about themselves. They feel baffled and frustrated in their spiritual life. And then they say, oh, ISKCON is a terrible place. ISKCON's going to fail. And they're really talking about themselves. If they're making spiritual advancement, they can say, yeah, there's a lot of problems with ISKCON. But basically, you know, they're not in this hopeless, despairing condition. So a lot of times we reveal our own condition when we talk about that. And so I want you to be understand that cultivating the holy name, practicing sadhana. Sadhana just means practice, but by proper sadhana, it's a political act. It's a revolutionary act. And we can become, each individual can become empowered. Speaking of ISKCON. That's why this is called the spiritual basis of reform, because if you're on the internet these days or talking to a lot of people or seeing what's going on, everyone is talking about how to reform. So I want to put this out as the place one really has to begin. So this is going to be about specifically what actually is proper sadhana. And I'll give you a definition of this, good sadhana. Because sometimes we say it in a way, chanting 16 rounds, following the regular principles, attending the morning program. But as we'll discuss more tomorrow, I've come up with a definition of a kind of a sutra definition of sadhana, which covers everything in a few words. Good sadhana is chanting the holy name while trying to give up offenses. That's the definition. And if you look at that and see what it means to try to give chanting while trying to give up offenses, you'll see it covers practically everything. And I mean the 10 offenses against the holy name. Chanting the holy name while trying to give up offenses. If we're chanting the holy name and not trying to give up offenses, then that by definition is not good sadhana. So then tomorrow, we'll get into this, how to cult the holy name successfully, what the process is, how Prabhupada talked about this. The issues came up when Prabhupada was present. that we do have to follow a process. It's not just chant and be happy and everything will happen exactly without any, if we're not careful. So that'll be for we'll get on tomorrow. And I think that that if you understand what Prabhupada has taught us, you'll understand that there's every reason to believe that we can be successful in Krishna consciousness. Not only can we save ourselves, we can save the Hare Krishna movement, and we can save the world. Prabhupada's given us everything. Our only problem is we haven't taken it. So, maybe now we can see if you have any comments, questions. Yes.
Yesterday, there was a person who came and said, I gambled, I know I shouldn't, but you know we have the key there, and you have the key there, and I don't think it's the same. I said, I gambled, and I know I shouldn't. And I didn't really know, like, how should I? I didn't know what it would mean by I gambled.
Mm-hmm.
He broke the principle, or he was just saying that.
Why did somebody you knew?
No.
This is a complete stranger, huh?
Yeah, it was a complete stranger.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know like, how to relate.
Uh-huh. Why do you think he came and told you?
Huh?
Why do you think he came
and told you? Because he thought that I was like chanting the Yukram, and he thought I was like the reception is there or something.
Uh-huh.
I was just chanting in the album. And was thinking, what is the key for a room or something?
Uh-huh.
Maybe Gamble's key, or I don't know. But he came and said, I lost my key. Do you have the key there? I don't know why he said that to me.
Uh-huh.
Like if he was there, I don't
well,
know.
Well, you could have asked.
Huh? I asked if you gamble.
Yeah,
I don't remember
that. Yeah. It's interesting sometimes if somebody comes to you and tells you that they've done something bad. Sometimes the thing is, oh, you should never have done that. That's against the regular principles. And the guy turns around and walks away, you know. And actually, he actually wants to confess. So, usually when people start like that, one thing to do is just try to be, oh, really? What happened?
Yeah, I was trying to inquire, but
yeah.
I don't know what happened.
Well, maybe he won't, I don't know. I've sometimes found when somebody comes and tells me, you know, I just did some terrible thing. I broke a principle. I say, oh, you must feel awful. Yeah, I really feel good. Then they start to talk about it. And because people have to feel that you're not, on the one hand, we have our standards, but they also have to feel that you're accepting them, not judging them. You can admit they recognize that they did something wrong, but also recognize that they feel terrible about it. That's why they're talking to you about it, and they'll feel better. And then maybe if you say, oh, you must feel terrible, yeah, I really feel awful, and you said this happened before, and I did this, and you said, what do you think you can do to make it not happen? You know, get them to start talking about the problem. But otherwise, I mean, I remember when I was a fairly new devotee, I had some kind of normal problem. with principles. And I told a god brother of mine, "You're not a devotee." Yeah. "You're not a devotee." Well, you know, what am I going to say at the end of that conversation? You know? He couldn't help me, and you know, I never opened my mouth again to that person. And that's what happened, especially in the early days of the movement. The devotees were very, very harsh with each other, and very practically joined in spite of them. They were really in the mood of chastisement. They were always on everybody, your case, you know. And so everybody just naturally, I mean, young people just off the streets practically, and it was the 60s too. Nobody was regulated at all, and all of a sudden you're following these strict rules and regulations. Naturally, everybody's having a really hard time with the principles of Krishna consciousness, but everybody had to pretend they weren't. And that's what it was like when I moved into a temple in, what was it, 71, beginning of 71, I moved into a temple. That's what it was like. You couldn't talk to anybody. And you're having problems and spiritual crises and doubts and struggling with their senses, and everybody turns to be sneaking around, you know, running off the ice cream or whatever it is. And we were really strict in those days too. Really strict. You weren't allowed to use Karmi toothpaste. No, because Prabhupada gave us this toothpaste formula involving salt and mustard seed and precipitated chalk and baking soda. And that's what we all used. And somebody had Karmi. "What, you're using Karmi toothpaste?" Yeah. Yeah.
Even if the person is a senior and this
is a whole topic of conversation, how to do things. It may not be appropriate. Why a senior person would come to a junior, usually you, if you have something like that, you come to somebody on your own level, or somebody who's senior to you, not somebody who's junior. So you have to judge the situation. Either maybe it's worthwhile just to get the person to talk, or maybe better to go to send them to somebody else. Especially if you're shocked that somebody so senior would have this problem, send them to somebody else, or tell somebody else, "Why don't you go talk to so and so? He has a problem." Maybe that's better. Yeah. Yeah, sure. That's what I'm going to talk about. The topic for tomorrow is how to cultivate the holy name successfully, to understand what good sadhana is, what is the process, what are the advantages of understanding this process. We have a doubt about Krishna, a doubt. The doubt is, I mean, there are many, many doubts, but one doubt: if we're convinced that Krishna is God, and that we're in Maya, and that our job is to go back home, back to Godhead. The other doubt is it doable? Can it be done? Can I do it? Is it really possible? Because you may believe it's all true, but only, you know, for Rupa Goswami or somebody like that, but not for me. And these doubts aren't helped when we see that people who are, Prabhupada calls, great stalwarts in devotional service, have problems. So I want to show that there's something we can do. We don't necessarily have to. I want to deal with that doubt. And I want to talk a little bit about the philosophy of the chanting of the holy name, and why we need to go through a process. What is the holy name? How are the different ways we experience the holy name? And what is the process? We'll take a quick look at that. There's been whole courses dedicated to this, that sequence starting from Shraddha to Prema, through all the different stages. I mean, that'll be the... And there's a very interesting conversations Prabhupada had on this, where he talked about cooking with fire instead of cooking with smoke. You have to cook with fire. If you chant Hare Krishna and don't follow the process, it's like cooking with smoke. Then the next day we'll review the three stages of chanting. The offensive, the clearing, and the offenseless stage. And the different way the holy name is manifest in those different stages. And how we can at least get on the clearing stage. And what will happen when we do that. Then the next day, we'll start talking about different offenses and how to clear them up. There's actually, it turns out, to become free from offenses, there's places you should start first and work your way around. We'll take some guidance from Bhakti Vinod Thakur, from the Harinam Chintamani. And we'll spend a couple of days on that. Then we'll review the thing. We'll leave plenty of time for discussion. We'll talk about what are the effects of long-term offensive chanting with a few stories from Shastra. And maybe we'll have some time, we'll get into Sri Shashastika. I actually started talking about this a year ago, this systematic thing. I gave a course in Radha Desh. This is a repeat course because I'm chairman of the GBC last year, and so I told them I don't have time to prepare something new, and they said, well, give the same one all over again. I'm giving one. But since that time, I gave this course in Radha Desh, I was able to spend a month during Kartika at Govardhan doing 64 rounds a day. First time I've ever done that. I can't believe I waited so many years to do that. When I did, I did the Kartika Vrata and chanted 64 rounds a day for a month. And I learned some things. So maybe we can talk about that some of the things. Some of my more recent experiences with chanting. Okay? That's what we'll talk about. If you're not interested in all the politics part, but we won't spend much more time on politics. Yes.
You mentioned that one can practice without enthusiasm, but to go to the highest level.
Yeah, right.
How is this possible?
That's what we'll discuss. It's possible. There's we're supposed to chant with enthusiasm and with feeling, right? But either feeling is there or it's not there. But actually, there's a way we can begin. But that's within our own willpower that will bring about enthusiasm and feeling. We can get a handle on this.
How we can get energy?
How can what?
Strength?
How we can get strength? For strict following. Oh, there's many different things. I would say the first thing is... Well, sure. First is some faith. If by taking this course your faith hasn't increased, I haven't done my job. The first is some faith. Adho Shraddha. And the next is Sadhu Sangha. You have to associate with devotees. We have to practice this in good association and avoiding bad association. And even actually Prabhupada said that faith comes from the association with devotees. So those are two important things, to associate with devotees, develop some faith. Faith, she's not blind. Not actually you have faith and you're going to have it. But faith comes from associating with devotees and by some practice, and you will see that there's some result, and then you'll get more confidence. You get a little more practice, you'll get more confidence. And then finally, you'll realize that it's worthwhile. And then gradually we actually lose our attraction to material things. Okay? Anything else? Oh yeah, I have some handouts for you. That little paper I read from is in there, and a few other things we're going to discuss.
Sometimes they're printed wrong. The top cover is supposed to say Spiritual Foundation for Reformed Student Handout, but the majority of them begin with the end of the Precious Letter War paper, so you just didn't see how they line up. In other words, the person is able to just flip the top sheet upside down.
Yes.
You mentioned that the mental ego system fell down in many ways. I just want to know, does it mean that in a spiritual organization, we became family, not just on the merit of zero spiritual advancement, but just on the merit of physical, like good karma, like good material qualities, and many people can mistake it for his spiritual advancement?
Oh, sure. That could happen. Yeah. Yeah, that can often happen. I mean, there's a reason. My own particular analysis of what happened in ISKCON. First of all, I should tell you, I know something about the history of religions. I hold a doctorate degree in that subject. And that really helped me in Krishna consciousness, because knowing something about the history of religions, I can tell you with authority that we're not doing that badly. Sometimes it looks really terrible to us. But that's only because that we have very high ideals. But actually, if you look at what goes on in history, we're not doing so also badly. Prabhupada made a decision. And when he came to the West, because of the failure of the Gaudiya Mutt, it so happened that only one person spread Krishna consciousness outside of India. Srila Prabhupada. It wasn't supposed to be like that. There was supposed to be, you know, dozens of sannyasis spreading around the world. That's what Bhakti Siddhanta wanted. But nothing happened for 30 years. And then finally Prabhupada in his old age went by himself. That's the history. And he discovered that when he began to preach Krishna consciousness, well, he discovered two things. One, that an unexpected group of people was interested. If you read Prabhupada's earlier things, the statements before he came to America, he was expecting that he had a cultural presentation that will be appreciated by only the very high class people. That was Prabhupada's expectation. Instead, he got hippies. And the amazing thing about Prabhupada is he obviously said, well, this is the one Krishna sent, that's what I'll accept. But I went through once and found a search of everything Prabhupada said about hippies. It is not nice. It's basically a description of people in the mode of ignorance. So that was one thing. And the second thing that happened is that very, very quickly, with surprisingly speed, people began joining the Krishna consciousness movement. So much so that it became very quickly more than one person could manage. People were joining. You know, Prabhupada came to New York. When Prabhupada named our society the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, the devotees that were with him at the time, I know some of them, They got together and they laughed. Because there was this little storefront in New York City, and there was a dozen people, and Prabhupada said, International Society for Krishna Consciousness. They thought it was really cute. And actually, they didn't want it to change. It was nice the way it was. Then what happened is Prabhupada had this little following in New York. But one of those people in New York was from California, went back to California, started talking to other people, and suddenly Prabhupada was invited to California. Haight-Ashbury, as a matter of fact. And You know, this book by Hayagriva is called The Hare Krishna Explosion. It was like that. All of a sudden, people all over, you know, not just in New York, but all of a sudden in San Francisco, and then wherever devotees went, in London, people began to join. And so, now Prabhupada had a problem on his hands. And the problem was, many people were joining the Krishna consciousness movement. Obviously, he had to delegate to other people the leadership function. He had to train people as best he could, very, very quickly, and put them in charge of other people's. And you could have said, wait a minute, Prabhupada could have seen that his leaders were not very well trained. Let's stop right now. Let's just have a small group. Let's go on like this for another 10 years until you're all mature, and then we'll spread Krishna consciousness. He didn't make that decision. He thought these people are coming, and he made the decision that he made, which, of course, it's the right decision. But anyway, that's what he did. Although, you know, if nobody's second guessed him yet, they will. They'll say, no, he should have done. I heard one scholar, Edward Dimmick, from the University of Chicago, write about how Lord Chaitanya made this mistake in splitting his movement between Bengal and Vrindavan. This is a mistake, you know. So everybody will judge. People, the early leaders were not very well trained. They were training other people. People were joining. They were not very qualified. And many of our early problems. And how long did Prabhupada have? About 11 years. So if you consider all those things, you know, that the way it started wasn't the way Bhaktisiddhanta wanted it to. That it was one person who only had 11 years that was working with very unpromising material, and then things happened very quickly. At a certain point, I think, when did Prabhupada say that? Boil the milk, I think we are opening too many centers, let's not try to make, so let's just concentrate. He, at one point, Prabhupada actually gave instructions, as he called it, to boil the milk. You know, not work so much on expanding, but in now our own practice. But people, it was easier to expand. After all, this started as an American movement. And America has many good qualities, but the downside is sometimes, you know, do a lot of things fast, but not very deep. And so, that happened. People didn't stop and boil the milk. It was easier to spread Krishna consciousness than it was to actually practice it. Unfortunately. Even when Prabhupada gave one instruction, people couldn't always follow his instructions. So those are the conditions under which our movement started. And so it's no wonder that 12 years later, when some of these people become, they're the leaders. I tell you, these people, the early gurus, Hamsaduta, Jayatirtha, people can't believe that they became such big leaders, but I tell you, they were Prabhupada's best men. They sacrificed the most, they did the most, they took the most responsibility, and I find I can't point the finger at them, because I'm Prabhupada's disciple, the same. You know, we all had the same access to the same amount of mercy. Why wasn't I any better? That's what I would have to say. So, but anyway, I think it's understandable why we ran into some difficulty. Myself. Anything else? Okay, so, well, tomorrow we'll take up and what to do to rectify things.